Hi, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I'm Colby Chamberlain. I'm a senior editor at Triple Canopy. We've been running here a residency at PS1 for most of the expo show here called Speculations. The future is blank. Asking a variety of thinkers from very different fields, artists, but then also novelists, poets, academics, activists, to offer their speculations, propositions about the future. I'm very particularly happy to be introducing today artists from the Pro Bio Show, another module here at Expo, curated by Josh Klein, who's also in the show, and then also including the artists Elisa Barenboim, Ian Chang, and Ajay Kurian. In particular, since this sort of theme of dark optimism, which sort of spread out through now the entire expo show, actually that kind of phrase and the notions surrounding it started in an editorial conversation at Triple Canopy, largely about Josh's work. So we're really gratified to see him then kind of incorporated into the show in such a wonderful way. And so with that, that's it. So please join me in welcoming Josh, Ian, Elisa, and Ajay.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Is this thing? Hello. Can you hear me now? Yeah? I'll speak loudly. Thanks for coming out today. Before I start talking about ProBio, I want to talk about the origins of the show and what it comes out of. In May 2011, I organized a group show called Skin So Soft at Gresham's Ghost, which is a roving project space run by Ajay Kurian. At the time, I was seeing a lot of work in the studio visits I was doing, you know, trading visits with artists and just meeting with people that I knew. I was seeing a lot of work that was concerned with the body. But it was addressing it in a way that was very different from the body art of the 1970s. Unlike the work that was being made then, the work that I was seeing in 2011 wasn't really about the body as a space for dematerialization or for resisting market forces or from getting away from the art industry or the art market or the system. The work was really about the body as an object, as a commodity, as a platform for advertising, as a material on a level playing field with all other materials. It was a body that was taken apart or augmented or enhanced by technology, a transgenic or transhuman body rather than a natural body. So I wanted to show some images from that show. It's a big leap from there to PS1, but I thought it would be interesting to see where we were 2 years ago. So if you could move on to like maybe Michelle's work. There were seven artists in the show. Michelle Abels, we had one of her photographic still lives, which incorporated like white male body parts on a level with the rest of the objects in her still life. Next slide. My own probiotic unhand sanitizer dispensers. These had bacterial cultures growing in them over the course of the show. The middle one, I swabbed the G-train. So that's what's growing in there. They got really gnarly. It was an unair-conditioned space. The next one is Annika Yi, my former collaborator in Circular File, her tofu wall, which had a video projection on it, which was a kind of trailer for her flavor genome project. Next one, this is more of that. This is a plastic piece by Jesse Greenberg. Sorry, I'm not speaking into the mic. This is a plastic piece by Jesse Greenberg that kind of alludes to the stomach and to digestion. There's a detail, you can see what's going on. Next, this is a still from a video that the artist collective Yemenwed did, which was sort of like an abstract pharmaceutical commercial, and it was in a larger installation that there was a still of earlier that was very much about the body. And then the next slide, this is more of Jesse Greenberg's plastic work. And then this is an image that Brian Clifton made. It's a composite of food, I believe it's chicken, with human skin. And then this is a still from A.K. Burns' video, Touch Parade, in which she recreated YouTube fetish videos for inanimate objects. And for instance, this one, it's a fetish for squishing food wearing white keds. So you kind of get the idea. You get the idea where this was going. Since then, because this was May 2011, I've come to feel that I jumped the gun a little bit with that show, because, you know, now seeing work that's come since then, things have developed even further. Like, this show was before Elisa started making her fleshy ceramics. It was before Georgia Sagri made her flesh clothing that was in the 2012 biennial. It was before Carissa Rodriguez began making her work with sperm. And it was before my first body part sculptures, which I started showing in later in 2011. So when Klaus Biesenbach and Chris Liu approached me about organizing an exhibition for Expo, I decided to revisit the ideas from that earlier show, but to look at where they are today, to kind of see where we've gone. So in addition to Elisa, who's over here, who has been involved with this dialogue through 179 Canal from the beginning, Georgia, who also staged performances at Skin So Soft, Ajay, who made that earlier project possible, and Dis, who also staged a performance at Gresham's Ghost as part of that project. I also invited Antoine Catala, Ian Chang, who's joining us today, Dina Chang, Tabor Roback, Carissa Rodriguez, and Shanzai Biennial. So because they're not here, we'll show some images. Oh, this one's also mine. That was flesh, these like paintings I did involving the cast of the Jersey Shore and bronzer. So the work that I've included in both shows approaches the body from what I see as a post-human perspective, or it's work that deals with what I consider the post-human condition. And by post-human, you know, I'm not necessarily going from like the various theoretical definitions that have arisen over the past 20 years. I'm really just talking about work or about a state that deals with people who are no longer human in some way or who have gone outside of the human condition. So people who don't think like human beings, people who don't act like human beings, or people who don't live like human beings, but in new ways. So people whose thoughts and bodies have been fundamentally altered, either through technology, drugs, surgery, or something else. This could be for either benign or malignant purposes. And one of the ways that I think about this often is how you look at cell phones, you know, or smartphones. Is a smartphone this magical extension of your brain and memory that lets you carry around the internet in your pocket and be in constant contact with your friends? Or is it a device that destroys all boundaries between your private and personal life, forcing you to work at all times answering emails and giving your boss access to you at all times? You know, so I think post-humanism is a similar thing. It's like, are you becoming like some kind of like emotionless robot, you know, that's just like a work slave, answering text messages all the time, or are you something else that's more driven by self-actualization? These are the questions that I kind of wanted to tackle with the show. So one of the things that I think the show also is dealing with is it's looking at these issues today, because there was an earlier wave of work that kind of addressed post-humanism or that was interested in those ideas that was existing in the 90s. You know, there's a very famous show that Jeffrey Deitch curated called Post-Human that took place in the 90s that had people like Jake and Dinos Chapman and Matthew Barney and various other people. And one of the differences that I see between this work and that work is that I think we're actually in the transition into this period. And I think most people feel that now. They feel that something's going on. You know, they watch TV and you see, you know, like Iraq veterans with like bionic legs walking around. So the work isn't entirely about the future. Like, there's a lot of speculation about the future involved in the work, but it's also very much about the present and contemporary conditions and where we are as people today. In terms of the form that the work in the show takes on, and this is what we'll talk about, I hope, in our discussion, it's primarily installation, video, sculpture, digital images, performance, Carissa's sound piece. Some common themes and interests have definitely emerged in the course of organizing the show, which came together in about 9 weeks. So it was a very quick turnaround and a very intense discussion between me and the artists. And we're going to talk about these themes today. Advertising display, flesh and prosthetics, the augmented body, the body as a commodity, artificial life and artificial landscapes, inorganic evolution, trend cycles, physical obsolescence, bootlegging, and creative labor. Hopefully we'll be able to get to some of these. some colleagues, also one of the other things I want to address since I've got a mic in front of me, some colleagues have tried to tie this work into surrealism or neo-surrealism or to various other things, and I think that's kind of a misreading. So this is also a chance to talk about that. I really see this work as dealing with where we're going rather than where we've been. Like specifically, like I think a lot of it is kind of anticipating virtual reality and augmented reality, which are about to really get going as major communications media. So hopefully we'll talk about that as well. So with that, I want to just introduce the artists and get into the conversation. We have Ian Cheng, Elisa Barenboim, and Ajay Korian. So since Triple Canopy's series is about speculation and the future, I thought we'd start with speculating about the future and where we're going, and also about speaking about our work. Maybe that's the best place to start. So I thought, I've just talked for a while, maybe each of you could speak briefly about your work in the show. We'll show some images, and then we'll move into the general conversation. So we'll start with Ian. Do you want to talk about your work in ProBio and where it's coming from in your larger practice?
Yeah, so I don't know what I made here, really. It's I don't know if you guys had a chance to see the show, but actually, can we go back to the first slide? It's kind of a swamp, but it's also slowly turned into a wishing well for people, and it's turned into also into a landscape for that vibrating dildo to garden. And yeah, there it is. And as I metabolize what I actually did, I've realized that I'm very interested in this idea that perhaps all technologies are not unnatural, that actually all technologies are an extension of nature. They're as natural, that vibrator is as natural to a human being as a bird's nest is to a bird. I mean, it's slightly more advanced or not advanced, depending on what you think of that, but it's an extension insofar as it was within the capability of a human being to make that. And I think a lot of my work deals with technology from this perspective, and simultaneously, I have this impulse to want to mutate that technology into the other possibility spaces that it would allow. So this is a very anthropomorphic object. Actually, both of them are. There's like kind of robotic animatronic hand that's used in a human-robotic interaction for hospitals of the future. And there's this vibrator dildo. And we recognize both objects as very human-scaled analogs to real things. But it is within the possibility space of both of those objects to do things that they were never meant to do that are not anthropomorphic. So we can never think of a cock as something that can garden a garden or a robot hand that can just kind of mush dirt all day. I mean, maybe our hands would, but no one could for the extension of 4 months. And if you can go to the next slide, or can you go 2 slides back? To the cell phone. So there's, in addition, there are 5 or 6 smartphones in the garden, in the swamp, and they're all submerged. And I think because of the vibrator, everyone thinks it's submerged in lube, and then other people think it's submerged in water, but it's actually submerged in mineral oil, which is a non-conductive fluid. So you can, it's that feeling of dropping your iPhone in the toilet, but this time it actually works. And so it is within the possibility space of an iPhone to survive in oil. Now, no one but like a Gulf Coast worker would ever experience this problem or this solution, but here it is on display. And then if you go to the last 3 slides down, yeah, this. In addition, there's a screen submerged, and it's playing what looks like an animated video, but it's actually a simulation. And it's a simulation that goes on forever. And it will constantly change. So if you were to come back tomorrow and look at this simulation, it will be in a state that's completely different and unique to any other state. And if you come back in a year, it will be really, really different. And there are some very basic evolutionary algorithms and physics algorithms running through it to allow it to, in a way, operate on a one-to-one scale with how things change in reality. Yeah, I think that's...
Alisa?
So these works are a continuation of sculptures that I've been making recently that involve ceramic parts, steel parts, and plastic parts, and silk parts. The works in this show in particular are all dealing with this industrial kind of body that, if you go to the next slide, that's a wall piece that is made of steel and has ceramic elements that have turned into kind of skin-like parts that are mimicking that, as well as impressions of other industrial materials such as screws and bolts. If you go to the next slide. I also use this gelled emollient, which interacts with the ceramics in different ways. In this case, it is not interacting directly because the ceramic is protected by a layer of vinyl, but the ceramic has the potential to soak up the oil from this gel that is made from a petroleum-based refined gelant. And has diverse uses such as pharmaceuticals and animal feed, as well as cosmetics. So it relates to the body in lots of different ways, but I choose to abstract it in this new engineered kind of almost medical table way. If you go to the next slide, this is another steel table with ceramic and gel parts, and the steel here has been turned into this like conveyor belt like structure that could potentially be connected to other tables like this and placed in modular ways around the room. Next slide. This is a work called Traveler Impression, and the top part is ceramic, and the bottom part is a travel pouch that hooks onto your belt. And it's connected on the surface of the steel table. The ceramic part is an impression of a steel auger bit inside of a meat grinder. So at first it seems like skin potentially, or... people have said some sort of plastic, but in reality, it's something different. Next slide. Okay. Done.
Okay. I think before getting directly into my work, I think it might be easier for me to talk about like where I've been coming from for a little bit, and then start talking about the specific pieces. For a while, I think my work's been about emerging things, emerging objects, things that are just about to come together, or things that are falling apart into something else. And I think that has made it possible for me to think about various sedimentations, accretions, and in a way, different conflicting time frames for various objects. And it's also expanded the way I think about all sorts of things, the way that I think about intentionality and how I now feel more adept at thinking about both human and non-human agency when I start making work, and how, you know, Ian was talking about this already, that this divide between nature and culture seems all the more arbitrary in our time, and that I'm constantly trying to figure out new ways to make that seem as arbitrary as possible. But I think it's in service of not naturalizing everything as much as it is to denaturalize everything, that there's actually something more, there's something very problematic about naturalizing everything. In a sense, it's like, it seems more politically interesting to call everything contingent, to call everything like not necessarily natural, or that the natural just doesn't even exist. And in this case, to talk about the work now, I've made these two kind of ecologies, I've actually used this gardening sense as well in describing these pieces. One of them is almost like this burned out landscape, and then the other one seems more like astral or cosmic. And then there's a wall piece as well that are these petri dishes that are inlaid with all sorts of various materials. The two kind of landscape pieces are primarily made out of various sugars. Sugars become kind of an important accessory in a lot of the work that I've been making, just because, one, it's like our basic makeup, and then two, the incredible variety of things that are made out of sugar and the material manifestations of it, like anything from cotton candy to corn syrup. It's amazing what we can do with it, and also how far we've gone with it, to the point where we have we can talk about DNA as a sugar, but we've also started creating synthetic DNAs, which are called now XNA, and it's all arriving from these sugars. So this landscape is actually made out of brown sugar that I bruleed with a blowtorch, and then cracked into the surface are these black kind of, I don't know, they look like some kind of volcanic rock. But it's a vitrified slag, which is made up of, it's basically all sorts of different kinds of waste. It's municipal waste, medical waste, sometimes chemical waste, that gets melted down with plasma, and then it's compressed into these little kind of chunks. And so for this show, I think I was thinking a lot about the feedback loop between the organism and the environment, and how we have now become the greatest geological force on the planet. And so the things that we've been making all along are now beginning to stick to us, beginning to cause this residue in how we are creating this new landscape. So this landscape is now, I think, starting to create us as well. And so that's kind of how these two works operate. There's this piece, and then on that little panel there that you see is little, it's a piece of the same image. it's a piece of plexiglass, and underneath it is a photograph of the inlay that you would see there. And on top are these polished stones and fossils and things. So all these fossils have various, some of them are a million years old, some of them are from a couple hundred years ago. And they're sort of attracted to this one digital image that lies underneath. In a way, thinking about how you can tumble a stone and erase its sense of time, and Tumblr as a source of imagery that kind of just is this flattened sense of time as well. The other part of it is this is another variety of materials. It's filled with corn syrup, aluminum dust, spirulina, microwaved ivory soap, which are those white tufts that you see there. The piece has grown quite a bit because I'm pretty sure just children really like touching it and breaking the ivory soap. So through human disturbances, we also have the growth of this piece. But basically, more or less, it becomes this agglomeration of materials and formal attributes that create this, for me, a kind of contemporary landscape of where we are, and allowing us to think these materials as our future tense. The petri dishes on the wall kind of arrived out of a very, I remember hearing a story about these microbes that are able to devour plastic. They can digest it. They're not sure if what they leave is actually toxic or if it's good. But it got me thinking that we have no idea what life is going to look like in the next 100 to 1,000 years. We have no idea where it's going to come from. It could very well come from all the things that we consider toxic right now. And so this piece was called Not Yet Titled, Not Yet Living. And I'm hoping that at some point in the next however many hundreds of years, they'll come alive, and then we can title it. I guess those are the pieces that I have. I don't know.
Yeah. So you want to skip to the next? Yeah. I'll just show these really quickly. These are the pieces that I'm showing downstairs, my own work. They're all the heads of architects and designers. that I've scanned, like 3D, they're based on 3D scans using laser scans or various photographic scanning techniques. So they're scanned from life, and then they're 3D printed in synthetic rubber and plastic. And I reworked them to give them ergonomic design elements. So two of them are architects who have actually vaguely been involved with PS1. She designed the warm-up, whatever you call it, whatever you call what they do out front during the summer. She designed that 2 years ago. And the other one is an architect who designs, this is Dominic Leung, his firm Leung Leung. They design the interiors for galleries, and we're in the running for warm-up this year. And then the next two are designers. You can skip on. Oh, this guy is Leon Ransmeyer. He designs high-end office furniture for Herman Miller. He was kind of the coup. So this is a piece about trafficking and about digitization. So it's about acquiring biometric information of these people who make ergonomic objects and ergonomic environments, and then applying the logic of ergonomic design to them. In other words, they're kind of designed after toothbrushes. And then they're sitting on plexi pedestals that are full of Listerine. So they're Listerine shells. So it's all about oral hygiene, which goes along with the kind of self-trafficking that they have to do as freelancers in a kind of precarious economy. So that's what that is. Maybe we should move on and start talking about the show and talking about other ideas. Because you can also go down. There will be time after this, hopefully. If you haven't seen the show, please go downstairs afterwards. So as I was saying at the beginning, like Triple Canopy, they've been asking everyone to speculate about the future a little bit. So I thought maybe we could start with that. And I could ask you all to tell me a little bit about what you see coming in the future, just in general. And also then speak to what you would actually like the future to look like. So what you think is coming, and then what you would like to see happen. Why don't we just go in order?
I think the future and the present is looking very nauseous. And I think that's probably an effect of things accelerating so fast and changes happening so fast that you no longer really have a narrative to account for what's what. I mean, even with new technologies now, you already have people trying to hack or pre-hack Google Glass before it's even out. And the script, the social script that you have for using that technology is already kind of being descripted and rescripted. And I think the feeling is nausea when there's no script that can be stable long enough. There's a really next level blogger called Venkat Rao, and he talks about the example of air travel. And when air travel first emerged, it was scary as fuck. It's you going at however many miles per hour in the air, and that they had to develop all kinds of, well, they had to develop a social reality and a script to make air travel feel not like air travel, but to make it feel like you're in your living room. So when you're on an airplane, you're basically in a really uncomfortable couch, and you're flying horizontally in the air without feeling the sensation of moving 400 miles an hour. And I think that effect on technology, or that social reality on technology, is always coming hand in hand. And that's why the future always feels really normal. By the time you get there, the future is inevitable. But I think right now, because things are happening so rapidly, there's not enough time to make you feel like you're in your living room anymore. Certainly, this is a testament to that.
I think partially I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the companies that make this future a reality, and how everybody's talking about the things that are happening, or like Google Glass or Monsanto or whatever, but the Monsanto is actually a good example in this, is that I hope that the future holds some responsibility for people like that and for companies like that, or potentially some more public discourse about where this kind of newness is coming from, because a lot of times like Ian said, because things are moving so rapidly, it's difficult to discern where things are coming from and to kind of engage with how things are coming about.
I kind of feel like it's like a, you know how they have shown that like if you put a frog in a pot of water and then you start like turning up the temperature little by little, it doesn't realize that it's gonna start boiling and then it just dies. I think that like we're like this frog that's like freaking out more and more and more, and the water keeps getting hotter, and we're just like, oh, we can move so much faster, and we don't realize that we're like ratcheting up this kinetic energy. And so there's the frog, and it's like his immediate environment that's like, this is awesome. And then there's like the giant pot that it's in that has been incrementally changing really slowly, but now we're like at that point right before boiling, and it really matters now. So it's like, I think what I'm interested in is that like there are these decreasing intervals of time for humanity, but the intervals of time that don't regard us are the things that seem most fascinating to me. Like it's that point of rupture that we're getting to, like the things that take a really long time and the things that take no time at all, and like how that collision is going to make our future. Not because we have no way of dealing with it at this point. Like global warming is going to fuck us no matter what. It's just like that's just going to happen. But how we kind of proceed through that is, I think, what the future is necessarily going to look like. And I also don't want to, like, sometimes I feel like I sound like it sounds biblical because it's just like this doom and gloom, like this is coming, but it's not. I don't know when it's going to come, and I don't know like what's going to happen, but there's a time frame in which like there's going to be a lot of hurt for humanity, I think, and we're just going to have to try to figure out as best we can what to do.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you're talking about frogs. I was here a couple weeks ago for a talk by Kim Stanley Robinson, and he was talking about climate change disasters. He was also using frog metaphors. He had some very good data about climate change and when we might expect some of the disasters to start happening.
Like when?
He was kind of plotting it out over the next 500 years. Like he actually thought that the melting of the sea ice would probably happen later than some people are predicting. Huh. But he was also expecting like the warming trends to start causing major disasters sooner than a lot of people are thinking. I could be getting this wrong. I didn't really take notes. I think we're in for some big changes in the future too, but I guess I think a little bit more about labor. I think about climate change too, but I think about what's going to happen with labor as automation really gets underway, and particularly what that means in a society like America with no social safety nets. Because I think one of the things that people really aren't thinking about, and you know, coming back to 2011, which is an interesting year to talk about, is you know, the economy and the workforce, which has been shrinking, and the lack of jobs now. And since the recession, you know, we've kind of bounced back, but we've bounced back with fewer jobs than we had before that. And one of the things that people only vaguely talk about, like I saw, I think, an article in The Economist about this recently, is that many of the jobs that were lost have been lost to automation. And so even though the economy is getting better, there are huge segments of the population that are just never going to have jobs that they have training for ever again. And I think the number of people who are going to be in that category is about to widen and expand radically. Like I think 10 to 15 years out from now, I think we're going to start seeing the white-collar classes losing all employability, because clerical workers, admin workers, the secretaries of the world, office managers, all these people are going to start to become completely unnecessary as software replaces them. Siri's kind of a joke right now, but I don't think that software will be such a joke in like 2020 or say 2025. And it will be great because you'll be able to talk to your phone and make all your appointments, and it will hopefully actually start making your life easier. But then at the same time, there will no longer be a job for you if you have a white-collar liberal arts education and you know, aren't set up to become like a significant artist or writer or something. You're just going to be completely unemployable. And I think these are things that we need to start thinking about. And in a society like America that's completely like work-obsessed, where our society is like focused on defining people by their professions and their careers, you know, this is going to be a real struggle because we have to come to terms with having like a large part of the population that's not employable. And this is all happening at the same time that other technologies, and maybe this comes into what I would like to see happen in the future in terms of speculation. This is coming at the same time that like automation technologies and like, you know, rapid prototyping, 3D printing, additive manufacturing, nanotechnology are starting to come into, you know, their own and provide the possibility of, you know, what some people talk about as a post-scarcity society, which is a society where like objects become like MP3s and food becomes like MP3s, things that are kind of just available. So I think, you know, like looking forward, yeah, like New York is kind of a doomed city that's going to be underwater sometime in the next 200 years. But, you know, maybe capitalism won't survive that. So that's what gives me some hope. So moving on, I wanted to ask you about like this idea of the post-human and like whether you think about that in terms of the work that you're making. And, you know, do you think that people are still human? Do you think that you're still human? If we're at a point where we might be becoming something else, what is that something else? When does that happen?
Oh man, I think we're like really just too human. Like we're more human than ever. And no matter how many prosthetic limbs you have, I think the condition of there, by virtue of the fact that they're just, I'm really into personality typing, and by virtue of the fact that there's so only like a handful of personality types, give or take, in certain models, I mean, this is, so there's conventional wisdom, and then you can like have models about the world, and you can speculate on these models, and in certain models, there's a certain number of personality types, and they each have their strengths and their flaws, and until we can neurologically change the brain and the ways in which each of our personality types responds to, for example, like risk aversion, our sense of protection, how we judge things, our sense of pattern recognition, until we can change that, whether to make it more extreme or more equitable or more horizontal, us as humans fighting over petty things, that's not going to change anytime soon. There's this new Kanye West album called Yeezus, and he says, what'd you say, there's leaders and there's followers, I'd rather be a dick than a swallower, but he forgets, that's two categories, but he forgets the category of the loser, which is the guy who knows he can see the leader and he can see the follower and he sees all the follies that befell both the leader and the follower and is totally aware of that human trapping, but is also simultaneously himself or herself emotionally dependent on the other losers, and so they can't ever overtake the true leader, and then they might graduate into becoming a follower, or they might have a total breakdown and then become a leader, and we've seen that in history too. But basically, whatever model you choose of the human brain and human personalities and the ways in which our, like, the ways in which we organize ourselves as humans, I think until we change that, which may or may not be really soon genetically, we're not going to change being human.
I was thinking along the same lines, actually, about the human brain not being replicable and that the most complex man-made thing so far is a human. So I don't know how close we are to being completely post-human. I don't see it any time in the foreseeable future. Unless we can, I maybe think that if we can put our brains into new bodies after our bodies are old and keep the brain going, that might work.
I think Ian, you kind of like underestimate the possibility of a brain being more plastic than, you know, than the given types that we have at this point, because it is what a model is suggesting is how things are, not how things ought to be or how things can be. I mean, I think potentially attracts, like, based on how things are, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but based on how things are environmentally, politically, and economically, these are the trends that we find in personality types and, like, how the brain is functioning at this point. But that doesn't allow for, like, real, like, events to happen and to change everything. I don't know, like, I feel like we're at a cusp where a lot of things can happen really quickly, and I'm wondering if the human brain has already kind of surprised us in a lot of different ways that we're not accounting for right now. And also, I don't know when we maybe stop being fully human in the first place. Like, to me, it's hard to say, there's the conventional understanding of, like, what the human is, but I think it's also, the more we learn about ourselves, the more it seems like we really weren't that human to begin with. Like, that this, like, previous idea of what the human was. So, like, if you look now that the microbiome is, like, all the rage and developing, like, all these new, you know, all these new, I guess, ways of dealing with sickness and dealing with health and thinking about health in different ways is coming from, like, all the stuff that is living inside of us. And is, if so much of us are other organisms, then how human are we to begin with? And then if we're looking at, like, the biologies of other creatures in the world and what they do, and if we can start incorporating that for us, genetically or otherwise, I think it's not going to take sort of, I don't know if it's going to be cyborgs or if it's going to be just, like, if we grow differently or if there's different ways that an economic change or a climate change can restructure things and can actually just, like, push us into something we didn't see coming in the first place. So I feel a little, like, tentative about saying that it is or it isn't going to happen, but it's hard for me to delineate when we were or if we were human.
I think we're in it. I definitely do. I think the frog analogy or the lobster or whatever in the boiling pot is a good analogy. I think, you know, it's hard to say, like, what the transition point is, but I think that's always true with evolution. You know, when you are going from, like, transitioning from one species to another, it's a continuum, you know? And it's only later that you can look back and be like, oh, this might be the moment when it's shifting. But I think there are some things that are changing. You know, thinking about what Ian was just saying, like, I actually think there are new personality types developing already, and you can see it in the way that people are using, like, their smartphones, which I think marks some kind of transition point. And I think with the Google glasses and the augmented reality glasses that are coming, I think that's going to get even more apparent that people are changing in significant ways in terms of outsourcing large parts of their memory and their thinking into machines, which is already something that we're doing on, like, a somewhat small scale, but that's going to accelerate, I think, more and more as these technologies get closer and closer to us and as we spend more and more time on them. Like, I've seen two people already walking around with these things on their faces in the past week. They look pretty hideous, but I think they'll figure out a way for them to look better sooner rather than later, and then we'll all have them on videotaping constantly. And also something I wanted to talk about is this idea of the cyborg. You know, like, when I was a little kid in the 80s, in, like, comic books or whatever, a cyborg was somebody who their brain might not have been changed, but they'd have, like, a robot arm or a robot leg. And according to that definition, you know, cyborgs or post-humans or whatever are already walking around. Like, I was at Freeze Art Fair, like, last month, and I was actually sitting with Oliver over there, and this woman walked by. She looked like Kirsten Dunst. She was, like, really beautiful, you know, in, like, a short skirt. And one of her legs was a C-3PO leg. It was just this jointed metal leg, and it was in a, like, very nice, it looked like maybe a Tory Burch shoe or something. And she was just, like, strutting around in this with her pocketbook shopping for art, and, like, it was totally normal, you know? And, like, you see these people on YouTube, like, some guy, his arm got ripped off by a crocodile, by an alligator in Florida, and now he's got this camo-printed, like, robot arm picking up his, like, beer, you know? So I wanted to talk about that, like, you know, like, what do you think about, like, that? Is a cyborg still a relevant term? You know, like, do you think there are already cyborgs, or, like, has it just kind of happened, and now it doesn't even matter, like, the term doesn't matter. They're just people with metal attached to their, like, knees.
Well, I saw this C-3PO woman at Freeze that you're talking about, And I thought it was the hottest thing ever. I thought it was the first time literally where I thought I would rather have that. Like, I mean, and I'm serious, like usually an amputation is seen as a disability, but this was the first time where I genuinely thought that an amputation for whatever reason made her like way better, way cooler, I had more desire for her in a very basic way. And I think you see that with that runner too, Oscar Pistorius. Minus the murder. When you see him run, you just think, wow, that's amazing. And you can project 20 years in the future, someone with prosthetic legs or whatever the next generation of that is could in fact become a better runner than him. And it becomes an advantage to have your limbs cut off and replaced with prosthesis. But I just want to say one thing about the species thing. Maybe the classical definition of when we're no longer human species is when we can no longer when we can no longer fuck each other, basically. So the day in which you confront someone and you just can't have sex with them, it's probably an indication that they're kind of a different species. And so that might be like in Silicon Valley, as you say, the way in which humans mutate. In Silicon Valley, they say like there's higher and higher cases of autism because people with the gene for autism are breeding with other people with the gene for autism, creating kids with autism. And whatever extension of that becomes, maybe that is the person we can no longer procreate with, and then they shoot off into their own Silicon Valley species.
Well, that's the thing. There are no like hard and fast boundaries. Like one of the classical like evolutionary examples that they used to talk about, like the boundaries between species, are these birds that live in the Arctic. I think they're puffins. They're like the penguins of the Arctic. They're black and white, and because the Arctic is broken by the Bering Strait, you know, all along that, there's this chain of different types of these puffins. And, you know, if you're here between these two species, you're one puffin, and let's say Elisa is a puffin species, and Ajay and Ian, for the sake of this joke, are puffin species. She could breed with both of them, but, like, you know, Ajay and I, we couldn't do that because we're too far apart. But, like, it's kind of a great... Anyway, nobody wants to hear about evolution. Elisa, do you want to answer the earlier question?
We're so far into it now. I guess I was thinking that it's kind of prosthetic limbs are kind of, they don't make us any less human than we already are. I feel like cyborg is maybe a term that came from a science fiction novel that meant something that couldn't be imagined at the time. So maybe we just need a new term for what can't be imagined. But now everything can be imagined. So I don't know.
It makes me think of, Ian, what you were saying before about like the how you have to create the social reality for the technology. And I feel like the cyborg was the term for when we didn't have the social reality. Like, it was just, we had all these projections and ways of dealing with it that were, like, kind of fantastical. But now that we have the literal social reality, like, you see it down the street, you see it at the fair, all of a sudden it doesn't have the same potency. It doesn't have, like, the validity that it once did. Like, it seems like cyborg was meant to be a fantasy term. It wasn't meant to be a real thing. Like, once you make it real, it has to be something else. Or it just becomes like the everyday. Like, it's just what we know.
Although I have to say, seeing this woman walking around freeze, it really did shock me. Like, I really couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like, it was kind of one of those, like, shock of the present moments. Like, the social reality was really, it was bizarre. Maybe we should take this back to art for a sec. So whether we can agree on whether it's post-human or what, which might just be a terminology issue as well, I think we can all agree that the body is changing in various ways. Like, how do you see this impacting the art that's being made, the art that you make, that other people are making? Like, what's the future of the body in art?
Can I answer last?
Sure.
I think
you don't have to answer if you don't have easy thoughts on this.
Things may become more interactive in the sense that people will come to art more like to an amusement park in order to have kind of like very real interactions with things. And things are already functioning in that way for some artists. I don't know. What do you think?
I guess I don't really know. It I feel like I should ask like whether you mean what's going to happen in the art, like in kind of the art world that we sort of are familiar with, or whether you mean just like art as like a category. Like,
it's kind of an open question.
Okay.
You can take what you want from it. Like, do you, I mean, for me, I'm thinking like, well, this show, I think, like ProBio, is looking at like changes in the way that the body is being depicted in art right now. You know, like a fragmented body, a body that's combined with technology in various ways. You know, we could speak to that, or like where it's going beyond that, or like if you see other.
I know what I can say emerging. Is that, like, based on the conversations that we had about these things, I think I am interested in shifting the conversation as to like where I have seen, you know, the art that I'm interested in, where I've seen that going, and certain strains that seem to be getting attention I'm just not interested in. So I'd like to shift the conversation towards like a new future-oriented understanding of where the body is headed. I think there's always going to be like an obvious proliferation of like many different things happening in art, and that's totally fine. That's like the healthy ecology of like a creative sector, I guess. But I think as we see these like new technologies kind of continuing to pop up and continuing to just change us more and more, it does seem plausible that the art that we're going to see resulting from it is going to like start feeding off of it more and more, just because it's. I think a lot of us are really fascinated by it and just find it really cool to start exploring those things.
I definitely think art's going to become less metaphorical, in that we can do on a more one-to-one scale the things that we imagine. I mean, maybe like, you know, a century ago, someone would have painted like a Brancusi on a hermit crab, and that would have been the work. But you actually get a pure weed work here in PS1, which is a hermit crab with a Brancusi sculpture on it. And I think increasingly, we'll be able to do things on a more one-to-one scale, for better or worse. And
but that's still like fraught with metaphor, though.
Certainly, but it's a real living thing,
right.
Subject to real living contingency,
right.
In a way that maybe a painting or a depiction of that isn't subject to the same. It's maybe also a kind of deep appropriation. There's the appropriation you can do at the level of an image, but then you can also now increasingly appropriate not just the image, but all its qualities, all its properties, because you're dealing with the real thing, or a simulation of the real thing, or like a child of the real thing, the son of the hermit crab or something.
Right, I see what you're saying.
I think I want to go back to something that Ajay just said, like thinking about moving art towards a future orientation rather than an orientation towards the past. Because I think, you know, if you've lived through the 2000s in New York, I can't speak for Europe because I haven't lived there, but if you've lived in New York in the 2000s, like the music and the art that was prominent here was really oriented towards the past. Which I would argue is a legacy of 9/11 trauma, but that's another conversation. You know, it was very art historical. Like, the interests were in the art historical canon, or reassessing various moments in art history, or, you know, 20th century history in general. And I think, you know, with this show, I wanted to kind of move away from that and look at people who are more interested in the future or the present. And I wanted to talk with you about how some of your work has been received. You know, thinking about Elisa and Ian, who were recently in a show at Sculpture Center that was about surrealism, or like certain articles that have tried to tie some of the work by people here in this show, or work by artists that we're in conversation with, they've, you know, certain writers or other people have tried to tie it to a new surrealism or neo-surrealism, to an earlier moment. And I wanted to ask you guys if you actually think about art history, or if you're, you know, are you thinking about surrealism? Are you thinking about the past very much? Or are you focused on the present or the future?
Well, I think everything, I speak personally, but I think everything everyone makes comes from somewhere. It doesn't just appear as a new thing onto itself. But I've been thinking about surrealism since probably I first saw it when I was a kid. So it's somewhere in there, somewhere in the brain, I'm sure. Parts of it stayed with me and got reinterpreted for a contemporary situation. And parts of it I don't think about it ever at all. But I can't say that I don't think about any kind of art that was made previously. I just don't make work about it, maybe.
Well, I remember that Sculpture Center show when they told me that the theme was surrealism, and I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I just thought, this is all really great. And I remember there's a section on André Breton, how he used to be a psychiatrist before he was an artist, and that he would use the Freudian handbook in order to... he would use dreams, obviously, in his work. And then I kind of just thought that, like, this is what we get now. Like, the seeds of surrealism are just all over, for example, the internet. If it's about kind of a form of, like, juxtaposing different social realities into one image plane, when you have 20 browser windows open on your desktop, which is effectively an image plane, you have that exact kind of assemblage of social realities. And I think we live with surrealism every day, and it's just more codified, and it's just called something else. It's called Tumblr or something.
Ajay, do you want to weigh in on this?
I guess I don't have too much to add. I don't... I think any time that you start dealing with histories and all of that, unless you're... I don't think any of our work is really paying specific homage to the past in that way, but of course we've all digested it, and it's just right now, I think there's a little more acidity in the way we're digesting things.
I mean, yeah, there's a degree to which when I walked through the Pro Bio show after it was all set up, that I just thought, like, no one here gives a fuck about art. Like, no one just... I mean, art in the sense of, like, art history, contemporary art daily, like, that kind of lineage of art, whatever it is, current and present, I got the feeling that we were much more interested in other things, and I think, like, I felt that you assembled the show based on the interest on things outside of art, or a large degree.
Yes. For sure. One of the things, maybe I'll throw something out there, because when I was putting the show together, I was thinking about these bodily issues and thinking about the body. And then in the course of installing it, because the show came together in 9 weeks, and most of the people made new work. Like, Ian, Elisa, and Ajay all made new work for the show. I made new work. Almost everyone else. So when you do that under that kind of time frame, you often don't know what you're going to get at the end. And what I got were quite a few pedestals, like a number of pedestal-based artworks, and a lot of video with sound. Way more sound than I was actually expecting to have in the galleries, which has been keeping me very busy. So one of the things that I realized, though, because nobody really wanted to show images, Dis thought about it for a minute but ended up showing video. Everyone wanted to show video or sculpture, except for Carissa. Carissa showed sound, but or installation, really. And what I realized, or what I came to the conclusion about installing the show was that the works in the show are existing on a continuum between, like, the real, the augmented reality, and the virtual. Sculpture and video and images are sort of just becoming the same thing. This is what I think now that I've seen this show and worked on it. Sculptures made in the computer, like sculpted in the computer or printed out then into reality. Videos that are sculpted in the computer, like the way that sculptures are made in programs. Images that interact with objects in, like, strange ways, like the way that Elisa, like, she will assemble her ceramics and, like, USB cables on her steel table, and then she'll shoot an image from above, print it digitally on silk, and then overlay it on top of the objects that she had shot. So it just, to me, like I really feel like instead of surrealism, it's actually anticipating augmented reality and virtual reality, like these overlays of, you know, digital imaging on top of the real world. I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that, what you thought about that idea.
I think, again, I might be coming from a slightly different place, but I think that's it's a fascinating like tier of civilization that we're at, but it all seems contingent upon like the non-digital world. Like for the internet to exist, there has to be a server, there has to be a cable, it has to go underground, it has to go through the water. If that ship backs over the cable, then Vietnam no longer has internet. Like there's still all the material things that create the digital world and all these things. So I'm still interested in how we haven't gotten, we still can't make a fully immaterial bubble for ourselves. Like we really think we're living in one, and for the most part we are. Like I'd say that's how we function for most of the day, but I'm still kind of fascinated by the fact that like when it comes down to it, if the power fails or if the lights go out, there is, you can't get on Tumblr, you can't update your Facebook status.
But the art world's also a very material place too, right? Like the way in which art is bought and sold is contingent on the fact that the work is... I make mostly videos, and this is actually my first sculpture thing. I've had, zero sales. and that's just an economic reality with being an artist if you don't quite make physical things. So I think... for better or worse, like that sense of materiality is here to stay, and I think like you're doing an amazing, like your work is amazing because it like you can be material in this other way, I feel. But I was thinking with your with the heads that you make that maybe in the near future, like art could undergo a kind of licensing deal in the way that music or movies does. In that, like 3D printing in the future is effectively a file or a set of instructions, and it's to a degree it's your pattern of thought imposed upon those instructions that is the work, and then it's 3D printed, and the way that like it's really annoying that Bob Dylan can like sing the same song like for 20 years in a row, and it's all okay, and it actually is all okay because every time he sings it, it's slightly different. It's a new iteration. It's a playing of that script, of that score. And I think with something like 3D printing, like that could be an entryway that is both virtual material and choreographic at the same time.
Well, I think this is what I was getting at in terms of comparing video to sculpture now. You know, beyond the fact that like with your pieces, you have 3D models moving in the... In your simulation, you have like 3D. Did you make those 3D models, or did you get them?
I stole some from video games, and I made some myself.
Well, you did make some. So you sculpted some of them in the computer. Like Tabor Roback, who has like the 4-channel piece in the back, he sculpted all of those in the computer from scratch. Dina Chang, who has the like flesh diamonds, the kind of fleshy prosthetic diamonds. Those started out as computer files. Like she designed them in the computer, printed them out, and then made molds from the prints, and then these objects are then coming out of 3D printers, which is similar in a way. I mean, it's not, but it's becoming closer to the way that video is dealt with, where you make a video on the computer, and then you output it on DVD, and you can do that over and over again. If the DVD breaks, you can just print out another copy. And I think sculpture is moving in the same direction, although you're still adding things on top of it in various ways.
Yeah, I actually take back my comment about like the two tiers. I think it is actually way more connected than that. It's not working so separately, and I think it is a valid point to say that the way that all these things have become layered and are sticking to each other in these really interesting ways is definitely how the way things are going. I actually am curious to talk more about like the potential intellectual property situation of art also, like what you think of. Like, is it okay? Is it if art becomes these recipes and then it gets iterated? Because that's the way I think of it. Like, if you can make the recipe and it gets iterated, that's kind of the art. Like, it doesn't matter. If it totally falls apart, you just make it again. It's not so much of an issue for me. But I'm wondering if, like, is that the way art is tending? I don't know. Since you brought it up.
It's been going like that for a long time. You know, like, since conceptual art, there's a lot of, like, score-based art out there that gets collected even by, you know, MoMA owns things by Tino Segal. That's just a bunch of oral instructions that get transmitted between people.
I mean, it's also a more resilient way to be an artist, I think, in that you're not so beholden to any particular materialization. It's more the artist becomes the pattern of thought, and then that gets materialized in whatever way, as time changes, materials changes, new possibilities change. But I think that would also, and this has historically been true, it makes an artist more resilient.
Well, there's also the idea of high production art. Like if what Ajay was saying, if all power goes out, then how is it going to get produced or printed? Or, you know, I think I feel like there's two kind of strands of going about this, and one is going into complete automated production, and the other is making things by hand or giving instructions or making a list or doing a performance. And I think those two could converge, or they could go further apart.
Well, I think this is one of the things that I was thinking, well, geez, I'm repeating the same things. I was thinking about this with the show, you know, because it's, I don't know, a lot of people have tried to like apply this like post-internet label to some of the work that falls into the show or that's been made in New York. Post-internet being this label for art that comes out of Europe, it's been applied to certain European artists. And it seems kind of inapplicable or like misapplicable when you apply it to some of this work, because even though, like, the way that I see it anticipating virtual reality is that the work is anticipating an experience that you'll have when virtual reality becomes this like photographic, seamless, high definition experience, probably like 20, 30 years from now, or 15 years from now, depending on how fast things go. It's a three-dimensional experience though. That means we should probably wrap soon. You know, but it's this experience that you have in three dimensions, this experiential thing right now that you can only really get through installations. You know, because you're having like a real experience, like it's a real thing that's not really replicable by images on the internet. So I just, before we go to questions, I wanted to just ask you how important that is. Like, how important is it that people see what you're making in real life as opposed to via images on the internet?
Can I add a little bit to that, John?
Sure.
Yeah.
We're just going to have people do Q&A kind of up on this mic so we can actually record it. But on another part of that, like, object insistence is also a really important aspect of all your work, is that sort of idiosyncratic materiality. Ian, you've discussed the sort of use of the mineral oil in your piece. Ajay, for you, the sort of sugars, or the microwave soaps. Like, these are not traditional art materials by any definition. Elisa, your kind of use of the clay and the highly toxic gel emollient. These are both like untraditional and anyways oftentimes very either like toxic or somewhat unsettling materials that you're working with. You're coaxing unsettling effects out of them. So in addition to the insistence on a sort of material object, there seems to be something about specific unorthodox materials also that are important to you.
So maybe now it's become two questions. Do you want to answer, maybe you answer Colby's first and then answer mine, and then we'll go into Q&A. Well, one is about, my question was just, you know, how important is it to see things in real life? And then Colby's is about the materials that we're using.
Well, I think if you see it on the internet, you might not believe it. Maybe that's the aspect to it that seems odd. Like, you might see the gel, but it might look like something else. You might see the oil, and it will look like water, even in real life, potentially. But I think the more people have access to industrially produced substances, like a consumer base, the more you'll see artists using those strange substances that come from our everyday products, you know, in their art. And it will be important, I think, to see it in real life.
I think for me, it's still important to see it in real life. I'm not going to say that it's, like, for everything I make, that's always the case, but I think for these particular pieces, you know, the burned brown sugar actually has a scent, and, like, the if you get to, like, there's also threatening things, like aluminum dust also causes Alzheimer's, so, like, if you're getting so close to it, there is, like, this threatening aspect of, like, these are things that can harm you, and then these are things that are also, like, healthful, you know, treatments that people use. It's all, I think it's all there when you're experiencing it as a body. And so, you know, there's also these little, like, crystals at the bottom of some of the pieces. There's little stones at the bottom that they're really hard to photograph. You just can't photograph it in a seamless way that would give you an experience. There's no photograph of it. that it's hard to integrate all that unless you take video of sculpture. And then when you take video, that's still, like, it's still another step, but I think once we do have a more integrated, like, virtual and real space, maybe I would care less. I'm not sure yet. But I do know that there are people that are already making work that's just made for the internet. Like, the jogging is doing that, and they're kind of just, it doesn't make sense to kind of make a lot of that stuff in real life, and it's also so flippant that it's meant to just be a disposable image. And so I think when you put all the resources and all the things that you do to make sculpture, as Ian, I'm sure you know at this point, because, like, going from video to making a sculpture was, like you were saying, it was, like, a big deal. And it is a big deal. Like, there's a lot of things that you have to take care of and make and do and mess with and, like, break and figure out in a material way that you don't have to do with Photoshop. Like, you do different things. You have different skill sets. But you can make something pretty quick, and even if it takes, like, weeks, it doesn't, like, it's a different way of dealing with information, I think.
But Photoshop can't give you cancer, and I think, like, what's really cool about your work is that, like, you get close to it, you feel like you could get cancer. And I think, like, they can't, until they make virtual reality or augmented reality to document artworks that can give you cancer, you won't really feel like you've seen an AJ work. You know what I mean? Like, there's that coefficient of nastiness that the physicality of it can deliver.
Right.
Or the potential of that, that I think these other forms can't. But like Ajay said, this was kind of like the first time where I've really had to do a kind of sculpture, and it's a huge fucking pain in the ass. I don't know why people do it. And I'm definitely going to do it again, because as an artist, you can never be happy, right? But I mostly make video, and so I'm obviously, as a making video, the world of video art is incredibly impoverished. It's kind of a ghetto, and, like, I'm really happy to see my videos shown on YouTube in a highly virtualized way, and I think that is the natural place for things like video.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I make Photoshop work, but I actually don't really like to put it online, because I think actually people have a better experience with it in person. And it's at a slightly larger scale. Like, people don't take it necessarily as seriously when they see it on the internet as they do when they see it in a gallery, like, at a personable scale. Like, the reaction is totally different, and people are wired to receive it in a different way. And I think I agree. You know, like, I mean, most of the artists that are included in the ProBio show are really installation artists. They're people who are thinking about installation. And I certainly think it's pretty important to see and experience these things in person. And then, in answer to Colby's question, why the materials, I think it's, some of this really just comes from, like, wanting to address the world on its own terms. You know, like, if you're going to talk about, like, Duane Reade, or you're going to talk about nuclear waste, or you're going to talk about flesh, you know, like, if you can use the real thing, it beats using a proxy, usually. And also, like, it's about, like, a language that people understand. Like, I think people, on some level, have all this information in their head that comes from advertising. And so, you know, in my pieces with the Listerine and the pedestals, like, even if you might not at first realize that they're full of liquid until you see the bubbles, you know, somewhere in your brain you recognize the color, And so there's always this understanding that comes with that on a kind of visceral, like bodily level, reacting to the color. Like even if you can't see the even if you can't smell it because it's locked in the plexi, somewhere in your brain you're still thinking, that's, you know, Listerine. And then you receive it with all the connotations that come along with it that are like built into our culture. So maybe with that, unless, do any of you have anything that you want to talk about before we move on to Q&A? No? You don't have a question, Lisa?
I have a question for you, but I thought I'd add it to the Q&A. I guess we can start the Q&A with this one. I was just wondering what you think of the post-human show that Deitch did in 92 and how things have changed since then in terms of materially, like the work that has been made since then that's dealing with similar topics, and in terms of how the conversation has changed. Because I know you've read that essay.
Probably. I have read it, and I'm familiar with some of that work. I think there's a big change from, you know, the post-human show that Deitch did until today, and in the work too, like Matthew Barney, or thinking about like the show that was just in the New Museum, the 1993 show that had a bit of this work, like Janine Antoni's work, she had these chocolate sculptures that she had gnawed or licked, and then she had soap sculptures. They were busts of her own head on like a kind of classical pedestal. They were like classical European busts of her head, and they were, you know, cast in chocolate or soap. And the soap sculptures she had, like, I think she washed them. She was washing them by hand to like alter her face. And the chocolate ones she was licking and gnawing at to try and alter them. But they were still in this kind of classical framework, you know. And even with some of the other work, it doesn't quite feel like it's taking into account like the impact of computation or digital technology into, you know, the changes that it was kind of anticipating in human life and the human condition. So I see that work as kind of being kind of ahead of its time, like, and the ideas that it was exploring, like, I think at that point it's really looking ahead. People were still using typewriters a little bit, not much, but they were still, you know, very close to it. I mean, in 1992, I was in middle school, and we were taking typewriter classes. People were still using fax machines. You know, like the world was much slower place. Whereas now, I think you can really feel that these things are going on. I think this is kind of one of the things that Ryan Treecarton's work has really shown. You know, that was such a revelation about seeing that stuff in the mid 2000s was that. It felt sci-fi. Like everyone's like, oh, this is sci-fi work. It's sci-fi. It's sci-fi. And then if you look at it closely, it's not really sci-fi at all. It's just like about a hyper distillation of the present, you know? So it's kind of about the present as like this future shock space. Does that sort of answer your question?
First, I have to say that when you said that technology is no less natural than a bird nest, I love it. It was perfect, and hence I felt comfortable pulling my iPhone and making it a Facebook status. So it's going to be my new motto. But I just wanted to say that I have a hard time grasping the whole post-human concept because I don't really understand what kind of human experience you're basing it on. Because if you think about it, like the whole one of the most important aspects of the human experience is that it's dynamic and it evolves and it adapts. So sort of basing it on some stagnant, nostalgic idea of like the human experience that was in the past and that was real, and assuming that we're sort of diverging from it and going to like an experience that's no longer human is, I think it's to a certain degree kind of fallacious. Because at the end of the day, all the Google Glasses we make, or like the environmental climate change that we cause with like all the bad products that we create, is also a part of the human experience. So it's a bad part of the human experience, but it is hence a part of the human experience. So what is it that makes you think that diverging from the past, less technology, pure human experience, we're now becoming something else? Why don't you think that this is also part of the human experience?
I think this is addressed to me. A lot of this comes out of working, and when I'm at work, I don't quite feel like I'm a human being anymore, and I feel like that's in a way that's different from the way that people felt dehumanized by work in the past. You know, like when I'm answering emails, I feel like I'm an extension of the computer. Like I definitely feel like I'm checking my humanity at the door, and then 6 hours later I come to when I leave the screen and I'm like, what have I just done? And I have no idea. It's like just a flow of information and me typing and like things dinging on my computer, and I don't really feel like I'm quite there. And I think that's a very different experience of being alive than say like my grandfather or even my father had, you know, like, or my mother. Like I think it's just really, I think we're living in a profoundly different space. And I don't think we're, I wouldn't say like I'm not a human being, of course I'm a human being, but I think we're at the beginning of changes that are taking us away from that. You know, like I think if you come back like 30 years from now, if people have like implants in their brains and it's like significantly changed and altered the way that their thinking processes work in order to keep up with the speed of communications technology, you know, I think you're going to say, oh, these people are not, from our perspective now, I think you would say, oh, those people aren't really human. What they'll say at that point, or what we'll say at that point, might change in the same way that, like, when we were talking about, like, cyborgs, you know, our definition of a cyborg in the 80s was somebody with, like, a metal arm. And now that we have people with metal arms, like, they wouldn't, nobody throws that word around, you know? Nobody's like, yeah, I went to the hospital and I became a cyborg, or, you know, like, I, you know, my son came back from the war and now he's a cyborg. You know, nobody does that. But it's, I mean, that's a question of terminology. I think there's still a phenomenon going on that involves taking us away from, you know, a kind of idea of a baseline humanity. But I really think we're at the beginning of it. Well, here's a post-human experience for you. A lot of the stock trading that's going on is now being done by algorithms without human beings, which causes economic crashes, which then disemploy people, you know? So it's like, I mean, you know, it's like a spectrum. Like, I really hesitate, like, going to extremes and saying, it must be this one thing or it must be this other. These things are complicated. You know, multiple things are happening at the same time.
I do think it also is a matter, it is somewhat perspectival. Like, I understand what you're saying, that if it is, if there are people experiencing it, then it is necessarily part of the human experience. That's valid, but I think it's a matter of, like, discerning transitions in where we are right now. Like, if we were to zoom out and cosmologically say, like, well, whatever's happening on Earth is part of the Earth experience, and we should just think of it like that, like, it doesn't provide you with much relevant information. So I think, like, talking about these ideas is to provide interesting ways of looking at things versus addressing it in, like, a scope that might be philosophically or, like, epistemologically correct. It doesn't necessarily give you that much information to, like, work with, to do anything with. Like, it's, I think a show like this is kind of trying to do a different kind of work that is still couched in our time. I don't know.
Wait, I just want to add to your comment about work. There's also all these funny ways in which in the contemporary office environment, they try to re-physicalize you for the better, I think. I used to work at Industrial Light & Magic, which is endless cubicles of computer stations, and they installed hydraulic desks that raise up in the afternoon, so you're forced to stand at your computer and not feel like a human question mark. So you turn into like an exclamation point. And I also just heard about this. So there are all these robots that are going to come and take over the factories of America. America has all these factories, right? Like, the factories are coming back, but they're going to be run by robots. But the robots are controlled not through programming, but through choreography, which is really interesting. So they'll have robot arms on the assembly line now, but instead of programming it, you literally hold it like it's a child and choreograph the motion, and then it learns that motion, and you choreograph a sequence of motions for it to learn. So there is, to a degree, a return of some form of physicality back into the changing work environment, for better or for worse.
Do we have any other questions before we wrap up? Great. Well, Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks, Triple Canopy. Thanks, PS1. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh.